Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Well, thank you. Thank you to our host. Thank you, Wharton, in particular, for having me. As the head of what's become a very large foundation, I travel endlessly and I speak an awful lot, but it's in behind closed doors to government people. Operational people, policy people, sometimes political people. And it's a rare treat for me to attend what is largely a scholarly conference. I'm not a scholar. I'm not a social scientist in particular. I'm a longtime practitioner in this field of international criminal justice. I do hold a PhD, but in fact I was still an infantry officer at the time when I did this when I was young, so that sort of negated any proper development of a scholarly mind, I suspect. So I think what I'll do today is I'm going to set out, for those who don't know it terribly well or have never heard of it, what the CIJA is, what it does, what it's designed to do, our overall strategic goal. And I'll leave it to those of you with a more scholarly bent to join what is becoming join some other scholars, in fact, who've spent some time in our headquarters in as you see fit, in trying to root CIJA into broader trends in this field of law and all this power stuff that you're talking about. So. The genesis, part of the genesis of the CIJA, or as the Americans call it, CIJA, I would say lies in an article that, or a book chapter that Morton and myself wrote, I think around 2007, 2008. And effectively what we argued in this article was that international criminal investigations, and this is certainly my focus because I'm not a legal practitioner in the proper sense. The future of international criminal investigations in large part rests upon, let's call it an expansion of the concept of complementarity, essentially in relationships between investigative and prosecutorial structures and private or really civil societal actors. NGOs, if you will. So the fundamental problem, of course, at that time, and indeed now, I like to think with the exception of CIJA, is that the human rights NGOs are not configured, even if they have an interest, to contribute to the criminal investigative and prosecutorial processes. As you'll know, human rights investigations are focused very much on crime-based, and they're not working to establish individual criminal responsibility where allegations are made that such and such is responsible for war crimes, crimes against humanity, individuals are named. It's a bit of a mystery to me that some of the bigger human rights NGOs with money, Human Rights Watch, for example, don't get sued. As far as I know, they never get sued, or very, very rarely. So, through some commercial interest that I have, or at least I had before I got involved in nonprofit work, I became involved in the war in Syria in 2011, initially with some small, as I said, commercial work. And the idea of public-private partnership came back to me. And in a nutshell, I proposed to Stephen Rapp, who was then the U.S. Ambassador for War Crimes and a former colleague in Rwanda, that in the absence of any kind of international adjudicative body and therefore any kind of international criminal investigative structure, that in the interim we could set something up, or I could set something up that would start building cases to some degree. That ultimately would be taken up by a hybrid tribunal, such as a hybrid tribunal would emerge from this conflict. We didn't expect the war to last this long, of course, and we didn't expect at that time the Syrian regime itself to survive. So that's the genesis of CIJA, and I'm going to skip forward now. 6 years later, this was in 2011, so 6 years later, SIEJ has become quite a big organization. It employs now about 150 personnel. Our investigative focus at the present time is the Syrian regime and the Islamic State. When Islamic State moved into Iraq in mid-2014, we followed it, if you will, into Iraq from Syria. And so operationally, we have two main teams, Syrian regime crimes team and Islamic State team. The objectives of the CIJ are this, and I'll speak about engagement in other conflicts, which we do to a certain degree, and we will build up in other conflicts early next year, I believe, in Africa in particular. We have two principal objectives, practical objectives. The first is, as I've alluded to earlier, is to fill a gap, if you will, fill the investigative gap in the midst of an ongoing armed conflict where there is no international body that is capable for whatever reason of doing so. So Syria and indeed Iraq are classic cases, but not the only such cases. Because of the work we've been doing there for quite a number of years, we've developed good working relationships with various law enforcement bodies internationally. Europol and Interpol would be the most important ones. And now, mercifully, the UN has organized itself through the General Assembly in the case of Syria and the Security Council in the case of Iraq to start building proto-criminal investigative bodies. So I'm referring to the Syria mechanism, IIIM, built broadly along the lines of the UNIC, the proto-STL body, albeit with the General Assembly, so no Chapter 7 mandate and not anything like, of course, the budget that UNIC had in the early days. And in UN Security Council Resolution 2379, which passed in September, a UN body will be set up in cooperation with the Iraqi authorities to look specifically at Islamic State crimes. And for political diplomatic reasons, it's not possible to look at anything else. So ultimately, we expect that these UN institutions will take responsibility for our case files, completed case files, for, of course, the relevant information and evidence that we hold, which is substantial, in particular in the context of Syria, and to a certain degree, some of our personnel, because handing over case files and evidence without the personnel who've built the cases, they'll have trouble. They would have trouble dealing with that. To be relevant in more practically relevant in the near term, whilst we wait for some kind of international adjudicative process to emerge, we've built a great many relationships with domestic authorities. As a nonprofit, we don't charge for services. If we're funded to do something, we'll do it. And so in 2016, although the process started in really 2013, by last year, we were working already with 13 different Western states, principally national war crimes units, and they submitted in 2016 a request for information to CIJ involving 417 suspects, if I remember the number correctly, principally Syrian regime suspects, in most cases thought to be within Schengen zone. As ever with these wars, suspects are making their way into Europe or moving westward mixed in with the refugee flows. The overall strategic objective of CIJ is it's not about Syria, it's not about Iraq, it's about changing the way that international criminal investigations are done, pursuant to the idea that Morton and I set out quite a number of years ago, albeit obviously the idea is matured significantly since then through the practical application of it. But it's important to understand that CIJ is a tool. It is not meant to be a substitute for public authority. Obviously, a private institution cannot prosecute anyone, And we spoke about common law jurisdictions. In fact, it is technically possible in common law jurisdictions to bring a private prosecution. CJ is not going to do that. We either fill the gap, as I've said, created where the international community, usually political diplomatic reasons, has not come to an agreement on how it should respond in a criminal investigative sense to particular atrocity crimes or patterns of atrocity crimes. CJ is a tool. Yeah, it fills gaps. On a practical level, what are the advantages? Why does this model work? There's four principal reasons that it works, and setting these out, I think this will tie what I'm saying about CJA to the broader themes, the sociology of ICHL or the application of ICHL and so forth. First and foremost, the CJA model works extremely well because we can take physical risks, which public institutions other than armed forces simply can't. I'm sometimes, for those who know me, or actually those who don't know me very well, I'm sometimes characterized as a cowboy. That's certainly not the case, but I have very high physical risk tolerance, and I have built the organization around that, because if you don't have that, you will not have any advantage over the public institutions. Not that it's a competition, but we're trying to, again, do what the public institutions can't do to make those public institutions better and more efficient, faster, cheaper, and so forth. So the result of that high physical risk tolerance, in particular in Syria, is that our people in the field do get hurt. The majority of our staff are locally retained. We spend a great deal of money, we're talking millions, training, mentoring, developing them. They're led from the headquarters. Everything's analytically driven in the context of the legal framework, which is international criminal and humanitarian law. Unless we're doing specific work for a domestic authority, then of course we adjust, most especially to their rules of domestic evidence, admissibility issues, and so forth. But we've had a number of people hurt over the last 6 years, sometimes in the course of their duties with CJA, and sometimes simply by virtue of being in a high-intensity conflict zone. Related to physical risk is reputational risk. Now, the leadership of CIJA, first and foremost myself, obviously we have to keep an eye on the reputation of CJA if the idea is to persist. None of us need jobs. I would like to retire. The senior staff are all very skilled. If CJA collapsed tomorrow, they can easily find other jobs that probably pay better and require a good deal less hours to be put in during the week. But we're prepared to take certain reputational risks. We entreat with a lot of prisoners. To give one example, especially captured IS fighters held by our partners in the Syrian armed opposition. Simply to have partnerships with the Syrian armed opposition is something that can be quite tricky. The way that we deal with insider witnesses, or our preparedness rather, to deal with insider witnesses. And one of the fundamental things that I certainly observed in my career in the public structures was a tremendous aversion to reputational risk, not designed to protect the institutions themselves or the offices of the prosecutor in which I worked, but ultimately designed to protect the careers of the individuals who are refusing or loathe, not in every case, but in many, many cases, loathe to take decisions that did carry an element of reputational risk, which could have been mitigated if properly managed. But they were loath to do it because if something goes wrong, they did not want to be held personally responsible. So one of the fundamental problems in the public institutions, certainly in which I worked, which is a good number of them, was a lack of institutional loyalty. Yeah. Mistakes can be made, and mistakes can be justified as long as the planning has been put into place and awareness of the risks is set out before the actual risks are taken. A third advantage that one has in doing criminal investigations privately is on the staffing side. First, we're able to attract very, very good people. There's tremendous frustration in the public institutions. I receive a great many unsolicited CVs from lawyers in particular, prosecutors. Hey, just in case you may need, I might be able to help at some point. Because we do have a reputation in the public institutions for getting stuff done. And there is a frustration, clearly, in certain institutions that shall remain nameless, that we're all sitting around, we don't have enough to do, if I could put it simply. And where we do try to do something, we're constantly held back by bureaucratic structures. So getting good people is not a problem. Of course, we have to raise a great deal of money to pay people, especially at the headquarters level. The salaries, in fact, are not bad at all. But there's no benefits or pension plan or any of that nonsense. Everyone's a contractor. But that gives us a certain hiring and firing flexibility. So if someone's available, we can have them under contract the next day. It's really a question of when they can arrive and start work. We're not bound by demographic considerations that we don't have. We have too many Canadians, Aussies, Americans, Brits. Paradoxically, we're not bound by that, but haven't ended up staffed like that. I'm Canadian. One of my deputies is American. Actually, the other deputies are Brit, but originally from Bosnia. But it's quite representative. It's based on need and skill set. That's the determining factor. And principally, what we're looking for is prior experience, and especially with the younger staff, language skills in the field. Hiring Syrians and Iraqis, we're looking for an aptitude to develop as a collector or investigator, if you will, in the field, and to set aside personal political convictions and focus in particular on the needs of the organization. Whilst we are an NGO, and I never thought in a million years I'd ever run an NGO, given my professional background, but I think it's fair to say we differ from most or any other human rights NGO in that there is real discipline in CEJA. There's no thought police, but people are expected to buy into the objectives of the organization. And where people buy into the objectives of the organization, we know they've bought in because they're going to work hard and work well, and seek constantly to develop themselves professionally. Where we don't see that kind of performance, they're gone. There's no staff counsel, there's no appeal. You can try to sue us, but we have a general counsel, and the contracts are so tightly done that you're just wasting your money. So there is a certain ruthless streak. Maybe this goes into the power, but there's checks on my and power and that of my deputy directors. Those checks come from, obviously there's quality control elements, but there's real checks from the donors themselves. There's a lot more checks on my authority than there ever was, say, on Luis Moreno Campos' authority. I'm not sure if my organization can fire me, but certainly reputational damage could be done to me if I was demonstrated incompetence or some other failings such that the donors would have me removed. Discipline, flexible hiring, and removal options are very, very, very key. And having the courage, it's rare in our institution, but having the courage to get rid of people. This is another fundamental problem is the public institutions are utterly filled with deadwood. People who are complete and utter waste of space. They have no business being there. They shouldn't have been hired in the first place. And or maybe at one point they were good, but then they started mailing it in. And managers don't want to get rid of them, because the amount of work that a manager needs to do to dismiss someone, the amount of resources tied up in these public systems and getting rid of something, so it's easier to just let that person sit and do nothing and try to build your work or your focus around those who are prepared to work. So, and as an aside, another fundamental problem with the public institutions is they lack leadership. There's people in leadership positions, but it's a problem in public institutions more generally, is leadership and management have become conflated and everything becomes management. Yeah? My job at CEJA as the director is not to manage. I don't have the time and I certainly don't have the inclination. My job is to lead, work with the senior staff to set out our objectives, agree those with the donors, and then delegate. And check to make sure that the different elements of the organization are working properly. Finally, I guess a real advantage, and the other advantage is speed and cost. If you have the risk tolerance, you have the flexible hiring capability, obviously you need sufficient funding, but you can, building international criminal cases is not rocket science. We know how to do that now. The paradox is, when I did my PhD, I was it took a few years, and most of my research was focused on reading wartime or immediate post-Second World War investigative and prosecution files. They knew how to build criminal cases in 1945. They were done properly. Document-based, insider witness based, focus on linkage, not crime based. How in 1993 or 4, when the ICTY was stood up, nobody thought to look back to see how it had done had been done before, and the utter rubbish that was produced in the first years, all crime based, no linkage, guys sitting in pretrial custody and trial custody, whilst the lawyers finally take responsibility for the case and actually build a linkage case which justifies the fact that the guy's at least in custody pending and during trial, is something of a mystery to me. But in any event, these cases can be built relatively quickly and to a very, very high quality. And that's what we do at CEJA. And what it costs CEJA to employ 150 people a year, our budget this year is, I believe, about $7 million. So as I said, the costs of staff and headquarters are, the salaries, if you will, are commensurate with public sector salaries, albeit with no benefits, individuals responsible for their own taxation and so forth. But people in the field, and that's really the key for us, because it's the men and women in the field are taking the risks and doing the collection work, which enables us to build these high quality cases. By way of an example, the Syrians on the payroll, I think, are costing, if I remember correctly, $800 a month, and then each sub team gets some additional allowances for logistical support, and of course they're equipped and so on and so forth. So you can do a lot with very limited funds in this respect. And in terms of administration, I asked before I came out here, 8% of our budget is spent on administration. So 8% of 7 million to administer 150 people. It would be less, but for the requirements that the donors place on us in terms of financial reporting, which is fairly simple, but there's all kinds of other crap you have to do. People have to have timesheets, and I don't know what else it is. I generally stay away from it. But and procurement rules for every time we buy a package of pens or what have you. But in my view, that cost should be got down to 4%. It's perfectly possible. But 8%, as far as I know, is pretty low. compared to, I mean, in my day at the ICC, when I left in 2005, I think the court as a whole had maybe 400 and something people by that point. And there was less than 10 of us who were out in the field in that case in Central East Africa. Now, of course, you have judges and they're clerks. They're not going in the field. But my point is that it was very, very quickly becoming an inverse pyramid in terms of a lot of administration coming down to a smaller and smaller and smaller number of people who are actually integral to the investigative, prosecutorial, adjudicative functions of the institution. So to wrap up, because I'm at time here, just to reiterate, CJ is a tool. Yeah, it is not a replacement for public institutions. Public institutions could do what CJ does. Ideally, they should do what CJ does, but I just don't see that happening. I hope that CJ ultimately inspires other civil society groups to replicate what I call, for lack of a better term, the CJ model, because I do believe this is the future. The consent of the donors, if you will, for international criminal justice is being withdrawn. I think there's a point made this morning. It's being withdrawn because of debacles such as Moreno Campos emails, other outrageous nonsense that's gone on over the years. But first and foremost, it's being withdrawn because it's the investigative process, prosecutorial process, is too slow and too expensive relative to output. I don't think that, personally, it's a good way to measure international criminal justice, but that's how the states that are paying for this stuff are looking at it. And states that are not projecting force, the Canadians, the Germans, Scandinavians, countries that are not fearful of being caught up or having their citizens caught up in international criminal justice processes. So I think with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.